Hello and welcome to episode 59 of Tabletop Game Talk, a show where we talk about tabletop games of all types. I'm one of your hosts, Josh.
I'm Chris.
And I'm Kitty.
Today we're talking about managing fiddly bits, miniatures, tokens, dice, cards, coins, plastic, and cardboard of all types. These things can add a lot of cool table presence to the game, but they can also get, well, fiddly. We'll talk about things we do to simplify the fiddliness, but first, a thank you to our Patreon friends of the show, Emil Giljam, George Gia, and Adam Harrison, and a thank you to our new patron, David Sellers, and a huge thank you to all of our other patrons as well.
Thank you, Josh. So our big announcement for today is Massive Darkness winner.
Yay!
I already know who, but we're going to tease that out a little bit, because we have other things to talk about a little bit. This is the day after my bachelor and Sydney's bachelorette party, which we all were parts of. But
only me and you were drinking, so our voices are now noticeably raspier.
Yes. So if you were like, wow, Josh and Chris seem a little, just know we had a lot of fun yesterday.
I'm carrying all the weight. Yes.
That's all we got.
Being 6 months pregnant really slows down your bachelorette party time.
But you guys had magic tricks.
We did. We went to a close-up magic show, which is apparently Chicago-style magic. There was a whole, like, history of magic lesson in there of, like, tableside magic. It was really fun. Very interesting. I highly recommend the Chicago Magic Lounge to anyone in the Chicagoland area. Check it out. It is way more fun than you think it is.
I wasn't really that jealous because I had a good time too. But my bachelor party was a little bit more traditional. Started out with poker, drinking, bar. It was a good time. We got back at like 4 o'clock in the morning.
Yes, you did.
So
I know, because the dog alerted me to everyone coming back at 4 o'clock in the morning.
So let's see. Still have a Massive Darkness winner, but first we're going to go to conventions. Gamehole Con is happening in almost exactly 1 month.
Yeah.
So first weekend in November, basically 4 weeks from now. And we have all our games are sold out. Everything is good to go. We're still looking for some help on Friday afternoon. So if you're going to be at Gamehole Con and want to help out, shoot me an email. I will hook you up with something fun and cool, I'm sure. And then VirtueCon, which I was hoping to be able to run a game on. This is actually happening this week. VirtueCon, I'm going to just unplug them real quick here because I feel terrible that I'm not able to run a game that's just happening right when we're moving and the marriage and getting crews and all that kind of stuff. So it just didn't work out. But they're a all virtual worldwide role-playing game convention. Basically, they use a lot of online tools to run games, but they run their convention as if it's an actual convention. There's keynote speakers and things like that. So if that's something that you're interested in, you should check them out. I follow them on their Board Game Geek page. So it's VirtueCon, VirtueCon 17. It starts October 6th, then it runs through October 8th. So that's basically this Thursday, Friday, Saturday, I believe. Friday, Saturday, Sunday.
Yes.
Yep. So definitely want to give them a shout out. Sorry, I won't be there this particular one, but I plan on being there for the next one because I don't think I'm going to get married again next year.
Fingers crossed.
Yeah. Hopefully this will last for at least 2 years. See how that works. Kickstarters. So there was a game I backed pretty late in the process, Warehouse 13. Terrence had brought this one to my attention, and I only briefly watched the show. Like, I watched the first season. It's a sci-fi show, essentially, where you're going this group of I don't even know what you'd call them. They're kind of a mishmash team of, they all come from different places, but they're hunting artifacts and dangerous artifacts, and they store them in Warehouse 13.
It's like the warehouse at the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Yes.
Like, where all of the mystical bits end up.
Exactly. So typically I'm not drawn to games that are based on TV shows. So I'm like, I don't know, but I've been looking at it for every week for the last 4 weeks. I'm like, maybe I should. And I noticed about a day before they were going to close that they hadn't backed yet. They hadn't funded yet. So I'm like, all right, well, I'm going to try to help them out here, try to get them funded. So they did actually fund. They met their goal. I think it was in the $70,000 or something along those range. The base game is only $50, so it's really not that bad. And it's a hidden trader it's a cooperative hidden trader game, but also there's a full cooperative mode that you can play with it as well.
Interesting.
So it does look pretty interesting. So I did back it. They are, like I said, the campaign is closed, but they do have a backer kit up. So, well, they probably will by the time you hear this, or within the next few days after you hear this. And backer kit, you'll be able to also pledge for it too. So if you liked Warehouse 13 and you like board games, go check them out. And then this next game is going to be the game to back. If you haven't backed this, you should just, and you've never backed a Kickstarter before, this is one of those games. It's kind of like Gloomhaven, where everyone, it's the hotness. It's called The Seventh Continent, which actually is very, in size and scale, close to Gloomhaven.
Really?
Yeah. So it's essentially a card exploration game. So it's mostly cards. You don't have a lot of fiddly bits in this one, unless you count cards as fiddly bits, which I do sometimes. But this one, you just
depends
have
on how they're used.
Exactly. This one has a few miniatures you're going to move around. All the cards are square, so you're going to explore in different directions, and you reveal different cards, and they might be resources, they might be ideas. I think that's a kind of a cool concept. You flip a card, it's like, huh, I could make a shovel if I had a bamboo and some stone. So then you can turn that idea into an actual shovel as soon as you get bamboo and stone. There's a clock mechanic. So each time you do something, it'll take you a certain amount of time, and you draw action cards to represent that time passing. And when you're out of time, that's when the game ends. So it's cooperative. I'll read their little blurb real quick. Seventh Continent is a cooperative game of adventure, exploration, and survival for 1 to 4 players inspired by the adventure books where you are the hero. It's also, thanks to the support of over 12,000 backers, one of the biggest board games, board game worlds ever. So it's just this massive sprawling like map that you keep revealing with these cards, because it's not a randomly generated terrain. They're actually linked together. So once all the cards are up, you're like, you are revealing this map of the Seventh Continent, which you're trying to get off of. So check it out. It has about 2 weeks to go. It has already funded over $2 million with 20,000 plus backers with 2 weeks to go.
So I'm looking here. You've got some info in the notes. Is this an expansion to a previous game, or is this just a second kickstarting of the same game?
It is both. So okay. Seventh Continent actually had a Kickstarter, I believe, 2 years ago. And I had not heard about it until recently. I think the buzz around the reboot
brought it back to the surface.
Right. So there are gameplay videos of this. You can't really get it in retail. It's never been released in retail. It's only been Kickstarter. But there are videos, playthrough videos and things like that you can watch. And like, if you like adventure games, adventure cooperative games, this is a really, really fun game. And it's been vouched for, essentially. I think it's rated number 80 on Board Game Geek, but it's rated like an 8-point something or other. So it's highly rated. But the expansion is to the base game. And if you just want the expansion, it's just $49, and then you have your expansion, which gives you more stuff. The base game is 80, so if you just want the base game, and then if you want them both, it's 129, then you have both things. But essentially, it's just like cards, like lots and lots of, it looks like file cabinets and stuff like that when you have it all put together, because it's like grab card 127 and place it next here. And, you know, so that's how you kind of choose your own adventure, as you're just revealing the cards as it's telling you to reveal them. So
each playthrough is a little different, sounds like.
It just keeps building.
It just keeps building. Is it a campaign style?
Yes.
Then? Okay.
Yep. So you're going to keep building and building and building. Your characters will change over time. Some characters will die. Other characters will join. And I think it's sort of based on what you do. So I have not actually seen anything besides the initial setup and what the instruction book playthrough. So there's no spoilers in any of the stuff I've seen. So I can't actually spoil anything for you. I'm just making these assumptions that you can die and stuff. I think that's actually true, because there's rules for how you bring new characters in. But so, yeah, Seventh Continent. You should definitely check it out if you haven't, because I don't know that you'll actually be able to get this in retail ever. At least they're saying that it's just too big of a game for them to release in retail.
Yeah.
All right.
Excellent.
Oh,
well,
wait.
No?
I forgot.
Oh, we forgot to announce our winner.
Of course. All right.
So, Massive Darkness, Kickstarter, Lightbringer, lots of extra minis, whatever expansion, one of the expansions came with the set. All of that stuff is going to Jason Marks. So
congratulations, woo, Jason.
Yay. Jason's been a patron of ours for a few months now. So thank you, Jason. And We're happy that we can give back to you, and thank you for patroning us.
Indeed. Well, let's go to some feedback about past episodes. And if you have feedback about this or any of our previous episodes, email us or go to our Board Game Geek forums, easily found at tabletopgametalk.com/BGG. So the first one is from Michael Ohl on episode 58. The episode was really good and I enjoyed listening. I think I know the answer to the question I'm going to pose, but there are a few points that you barely touched on that are hot button topics for this particular theme. The first being what Chris seemed to tiptoe around a lot, how he really wanted to come out and say these games you were discussing are bad and should be avoided. I love how you ended the episode with the thought that these games actually gave you great memories, which is the best part of all the games for me. So many people have an instant disdain for games in this category. If you don't believe this, mention Life or Monopoly in an LGS or try to start a discussion on Reddit, Facebook, or even one of the bigger BGG communities. The trolls all come out for any mention of these games.
Yeah, so I think we all sort of had the intention of going in and saying how bad these games were.
Yeah.
I actually didn't, but I could see that there was a lot of that sentiment out there.
Well, on the BGG thread, definitely, yeah. For sure. And then once we got started talking about it, we sort of talked ourselves into thinking that maybe these aren't actually that bad. It's just games that we've played a lot, just like any other game where you might have just played it out.
You get burnout. And yeah, maybe some of these games are not the best games, but they were so widespread and they're so common to everyone that, you know, there is that common ground. So.
And I think one of the things I don't know that we touched on really, because I was sort of trying to get at, you know, honestly, there's a lot of new people because of the ad. So I just want to explain what a lot of people might not know. When we put out the topics and I put in the little blurb of what we're going to talk about, that helps us start the conversation. But we really don't have any idea where the conversation is going to go much of the time. You know, we might have bullet points and whatever. So that particular episode, our last episode, was one of those things where we organically came to a different conclusion than what we thought we were going to talk about. And I think that these mass market mainstream games are very approachable. And I don't actually know, because I started to think, well, maybe it's bad because, you know, if everyone just thinks Monopoly is board games, it's, you know, bad for the hobby, right? Because everyone thinks, oh, that's all there is to offer. But if everybody sees Monopoly outside of the hobby, you know, the hobby gamer, they look at Monopoly as a valid and fun board game. Maybe that's not actually bad. You can say, oh, you're playing Monopoly. Yeah, I liked that game too. And then I discovered these other games, as opposed to, well, Monopoly sucks. So, you know, you don't really know what a board game is.
We're incapable of being mean to these games. Yeah. I'm so sorry that I feel like we've let you down, Michael, with our inability to just bash these.
No, but I think it's good. I was kind of surprised. I want to say that in the blurb at the beginning of last episode, there was a little bit of like, you know, oh, are we just going to bash these? And I was like, why though? It doesn't make any sense to me. Like, these games are a gateway, as we have said, and as we're saying right now, for everyone to get into the hobby. And they're, like you said, they're so approachable that everyone can play. Everyone can play together, different ages, different ability levels, different interest levels of the hobby. So I don't know. It's hard for me to say anything other than, okay, the game mechanics aren't as interesting for a hardcore gamer.
Yeah.
And now you hear so much bashing of new gateway games. You know, it's just that they're gateway games. They're easily understood. They have small rule sets. They're meant to be approachable to everyone. Some people just are never going to get into that. And, you know, I think, you know, 20, 30 years from now, this is what we're going to be hearing about Settlers of Catan, Ticket to Ride, yeah. Well, all the people growing up with those games as their mass market gateway games.
Yeah. And already we bash, you know, Settlers of Catan. Oh, yeah. Like, if you're in the hobby, like Settlers of Catan, no, why would anyone play that when there's all these other games? Again, when we talked about that, we found reasons why, because it was fun and easy to get into, and it exposed you to a new set of games. It wasn't bad at the time. It's just not something we would want to go back and play right now, because we know there's other things out there. So let's jump ahead to Sam's comment, because I think that really dovetails into this really well.
All right. So Sam says, hey, guys, great episode. I really enjoyed the episodes that make you reflect, and listening to you grapple with your shift in attitude from distasteful to nostalgic was interesting to listen to at the very least. One important piece that didn't come up was how the marketing of mass market games seeps into pop culture. How often in non-gaming situations have you said, do not pass go, do not collect $200, or you sank my battleship, or sorry, or some variation of Colonel Mustard in the library with the candlestick. The advertising for some of these classic games created catchphrases that are drilled into the subconsciouses of so many. Are there any good catchphrases for modern games you can think of, or even marketing campaigns that stick with you? How many outside of the gaming hobby even recognize wood for sheep?
Yeah.
I swear I'm not the hungover one. Sorry
no,
about that
no,
reading.
No, you're good. and I think that's a good point, though. It's like these games are part of our subculture. It's we don't even think. I mean, do not, you know, sorry. Or yeah, do not pass go. Do not collect $200. Like, I've used that all the time. Yeah.
I don't know if this counts, but last night Spencer actually said, that's something a Cylon would say in reference to Battlestar Galactica board game. I mean, it's not really part of the game, but he likes to say that one.
Yeah. I use it a lot of like, nope, I failed my deck save on that one. You know, if you like stumble over a curb or something like that. But again, I think those ones are more hobbyist terms that we can kind of use as inside jokes. You know, you sank my battleship. Everybody knows this.
I use that one.
Yep. Yeah. Even if you've never played Battleship, you know this phrase. So now I don't think that there are any mass marketing campaigns today that are doing the same thing.
Well, here's the thing. Most of these ad campaigns are geared at children. They're on children's TV. Mm. These are children's games that they are marketing towards children. This is from our childhoods. So I don't know that they market games like this towards children anymore. They kind of rely on parents to find and introduce them. They're more marketed towards parents to introduce to your kids. So they don't have those silly catchphrases, because I can think of a bunch of catchphrases from games that are not classic or have stuck around, like Don't Wake Daddy or Pizza Party. And I even remember a bunch of ad campaigns for things that are not board games that had big catchphrases that, you know, became kind of innocuous statements to our generation. So I don't know if it's so much the games themselves or if it's the ads geared towards children about the games.
Yeah. So we just need to advertise to kids more.
Yeah.
That makes sense. Yeah. and Michael, we will be having... So Michael went on to talk about doing an episode on games that are being redone. So we're going to do an episode on that. I'm not skipping over that. Quick question.
You're really struggling with your voice. It sounded like you were having an Oprah moment. You were getting really choked up and emotional, but it's just because you're...
So I'm drinking tea and I sort of inhaled some of it. So we're good. We're all good.
Sure.
It's coming back. These all questions right. are for you guys anyway, so I don't have to talk.
All right. So quick question from Sam. Yeah, we actually have a couple here. For Josh and Kitty. What, if any, games will Josh take on his family trip to see his family? Games on the iPad, small compact solo games, something portable. Might I recommend Mintworks if you have not already played it?
I definitely haven't played it. I even asked Chris if he'd heard of Mintworks and he hadn't, which is crazy to me. So yeah, I'll definitely check that one out. I think Wordsy is going to be a great one. It's got a very small footprint. My family love word games. They're really into Scattergories, which I also really enjoy. So I can definitely take Wordsy. So thanks, Chris, for getting me that one. I'd like to take Wits and Wagers because I still haven't tried it out, and it looks like a great kind of party game for lots of people, but there's a lot of fiddly bits with that one, so I don't know if I'll be able to fit it in the luggage. We'll see.
All right, and he goes on to both of us. When your friends or family learn you do a podcast about games, what kind of pressure do you feel recommending the right game for them?
Maybe I should feel more pressure. I actually don't feel any pressure whatsoever. I guess I don't know why. Maybe it's just because I don't think about it too hard. You know, it's nice when you can do that. Now that I have the kind of more knowledge, I am able to think, oh, this would be a game. So I kind of feel it's almost the opposite of that. It's kind of much easier now for me to be like, oh, I could buy someone a board game. I know a bit more.
So I have kind of like two different categories of reaction when I say I'm on a gaming podcast, where people either have like no idea what that means and I end up explaining to them, and then I do feel like, you know, it's pretty easy to bring games to the table that I know they're gonna like because they don't have a lot of experience. But I do know a lot of people who are really into board gaming, and then I feel like I really have to kind of like prove my knowledge to those people much more so than I feel like people who don't know very much about board gaming.
Yeah, I guess I still don't consider myself much of an expert despite being on this show. So it's kind of like I'm letting myself off here. I'm like, oh yeah, I'm on this show, but you know, I still don't know my ass from my elbow.
You're the question guy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I'm the noob still.
Yeah, whereas I feel like I need to kind of like represent like our podcast. Like I have to be like good at this now. So it puts a lot of pressure on me.
Right.
So yes, I do feel lots of pressure of every kind. So I just like am paralyzed. But usually I haven't introduced a game to somebody that they were like, I hate this and I never want to play again and I'm never going to play another game you suggest. So I feel like I'm doing good.
Yeah. I think the error on the side of something simple and let them grow into the more complex stuff. Unless they're actual gamers. And then if they're actual gamers, like, well, what do you like? And then it makes it much easier to recommend the next step.
Yeah. I just want to make everyone play Time Stories with me now.
We'll talk about it. All right. One more question from Aaron.
All right. What do you think about the hype machine? Does it help the game industry? Does the cacophony drown out the truly good but not necessarily pretty looking games? Anyone heard of Cockroach Poker, Dogs of War? Are companies able to just buy a top listing on BoardGameGeek through marketing? Some Fantasy Flight games?
Yep.
There we go. Possibly, does the hype tornado a good game through major disappointment? Seafall comes to mind here.
Oh, I think it was Torpedo. I read that in the pre-notes as Tornado as well. I made that sound.
It says Torpedo even.
Yeah.
Wait, I can't read.
No, but I did the same thing before.
Oh, thank you for backing me up here, Josh.
Yeah.
So does the hype torpedo a good game through major disappointments? Such as Seafall.
I can't read today. I'm really sorry, everyone.
It's totally fine. I can't talk, so it's all
all right.
It's all good. Actually, that's not true. I love to talk, and the more I'm talking, the more I'm getting into it. I'm ready. I want to talk about hype. So I worked in the video game industry for quite a while, and hype is a science of sales, especially for games. I was actually working in the early 2000s, so the internet was around, but it wasn't like as huge as it is today as far as like YouTube and all of those types of things. But there was an actual timeline where we wanted to start hyping something no more than 6 months before release. And you wanted a certain number of clicks so you could see that your hype was trending in the right direction. If you did it too early, then the hype, you know, explodes and then it kind of trickles off as it's like, well, I heard this game was coming out, but
it's not out yet. Yeah.
Yep.
Did that come out? I don't know. That kind of thing.
Right. And if you do it too late, then you don't have enough hype to actually have retailers want to put that game on the shelves. So there is kind of this area where you have to go. Unfortunately, hype is just part of game design. So you can design and have the best game ever, but if it's only ever on your kitchen table and you never took it to production, it doesn't matter you have the best game ever, and nobody should care that you have the best game ever because they can't play it. So then you take it to production. It's like, okay, I want to make it available for lots of other people to get. Great. It's out there. Anyone can go and buy it. There's 10,000 other games on the shelves, and that's not even hyperbole. That's an actual, you know, realistic number. How are they going to know that your game is worth them looking at? You know, they're not going to play every single game. That's crazy expensive, crazy time consuming, and nobody should have to do that. So that hype and that advertisement, that's the next step in saying, I built this great game. It was awesome on my kitchen table. I sent it to production. It went out there. And now, hey, everyone, take a look at this great game I made. This is what it is. Build that hype. Sometimes it fails. Seafall, you know, not a great game. They sold a bunch of copies, though. So from the production side, from the producer, that was great. For us as gamers, yeah, we get it around pretty quick. And if you don't ride the edge of the hype machine, you can see what other people review it as and go from there.
Well, I think what he was going for with Seafall was that it was so hyped. It was so the follow-up to Pandemic Legacy. It was going to be such a fun game that everyone had such high expectations. Like, if you had gone in with maybe lower expectations, would you have enjoyed the game more?
Yep. And that's the thing you have to control. First Martians, because it's sitting on the table right now, is a good example of that as well. You know, super hyped game. And Portal Games was actually trying to back away and reduce the hype. They wanted to lower the expectations for the game. And rightfully so.
Because we put it on the table and didn't even play it.
Yes.
And packed it right back up because we were just like, no.
Yeah.
Not in the mood today.
Yep. And I have played it, but yeah, when we're talking something about Fiddly Bits, this is a game that has a large fiddly bit to action ratio. But we will get to that. We'll get to that right now. So let's switch all over.
In this episode, we're talking about fiddly bits and how we keep the bling of the game from getting in the way of playing the game. Managing the bits can be overwhelming from the moment you open up a new game and especially when putting it away. We'll talk about ways to help manage all of this right now.
Yeah, so this one, this is another topic where Josh is like, how are we going to talk about fiddly
bits? No. I didn't say how are we going to talk about fiddly.
Josh has learned his lesson.
No, my thing was I don't care about fiddly bits.
Oh.
But the reason I realized I don't care is because you do all my fiddly bit management. I play all my games with you and I turn up and everything's ready and then everything gets... I mean, I help pack away, but you know, you've got it sorted.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot to it.
I bet.
I would say me and Chris actually fight over fiddly bit management sometimes.
It's true.
Yeah.
I'm glad there's people in the world like, that notice. Even like, yeah, like doing this sort of thing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't want to go back to Monopoly on every single show, but it is kind of funny because Monopoly was the first like designated fiddly bit manager. You know, you had the banker in the rules. Yeah. Somebody's going to be the banker. And you either loved being the banker or you wanted nothing to do with being the banker.
I was always the banker.
I was always the banker, too. I'm like, I must have control of the
Josh,
money.
Josh, have you ever been the banker?
I don't think so, no.
Yeah. There's two kinds of people. Yep.
There's the bankers of the world, and there's everyone else that just wants the money handed to them.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's actually, wow, we could just end the show right there.
No.
There's so many more fiddly bits to talk about.
There are. So when I started putting some bullet points together for this, I'm like, wow, there's way more here than I even anticipated. Because what I first thought, this actually came out of, we were playing Dead of Winter.
Yes.
And I was just kind of managing all the zombies and moving all the things and, you know, move these cards there and we'll count this and we advanced or not and move all the little dials and levers. And I just was taking care of all of that. And I typically do that in most games I play, primarily because I'm the one that knows the rules. So it's easy to just kind of maintain the board state. But Kitty's like, well, this is closer to me, so I'm going to start doing this, and I'm going to manage that, I'm going to manage that.
I'm and like, Chris couldn't stop doing it for me.
Well, not on purpose. It's just kind of out of habit, you know? It's just like, I move these things. They're like, no, I already updated the morale track, you know, so that's fine. I'm like, okay.
That's hilarious, because I really did not notice that battle that was going on. This is the first time I was aware of it, and I was playing that game with you guys.
You were right there.
You were right there.
Yes. I kept adding wounds to people, and Chris would go, like, he's looking for them over there. And then like it became like a race to see like who could get wounds on people faster, or at least I was racing.
Yep.
Yeah.
So then it got me to think, it's like, well, do groups normally have like that designated person that manages the bits and everyone else just kind of shows up and those are all handled for them? So that's where my initially started. And I was going to, you know, talk about being that person and, you know, the responsibilities of that person. But then I started like thinking about all the things that are fiddly bits. So I came up with a list at the top of the show, but we have minis, which are all over the place now. And a lot of times the miniatures are different molds and the molds determine what they are. So you have to like look at each miniature to figure out, okay, this is this kind of guy, this is that kind of guy. That can be a pain, you know, depending on how distinct those are. You're like, you're searching for, you know, gray plastic differences.
Do meeples come under this category?
Not necessarily, but right. Yes, they're still fiddly bits for right. Sure.
He does have a bullet point here of minis, standees, and tokens.
Right.
And I would put meeples in as tokens.
That's true.
Yeah, because then you have the standees, and the standees are cardboard punch-outs and then the plastic thing. So Dead of Winter has a lot of zombies, actually all standees in Dead of Winter.
Yes.
Now the standees, a little bit easier if you're looking head-on to determine what they are, but then you're trying to match the picture on the card with the picture on the standee, which takes a tremendous amount of like time to scan those things.
Especially if you accidentally turn one sideways and you're looking at a piece of cardboard standing up just the side. You're like, oh, well, these are all gray cardboard figures about 3 inches tall.
Yep. Well, and that, like, if you're sitting around a table and you have a bunch of standees on there, someone's always going to be at an angle where they can't see the faces of the standees. So the fiddly bit manager, or just managing those fiddly bits, means turning the cardboard pieces so that you can see them. And when a game does that, it adds this extra level of, I don't want to say complexity, but I think the best word is fiddliness.
It's interesting with these sort of pieces of user experience, because I remember listening to a TED talk by Gabe Zuckerman, I think his name is, and he was talking about how actually sometimes the most efficient user experience isn't always the most interesting or fun. Sometimes, even though these things can be a little bit more difficult, maybe that's fun for someone, like maybe scanning through the sea of zombies and people for your character. Wait, is my character in the library? I don't know. Oh, I can't even see. Oh, there they are. Oh, thank God. You know, maybe that's an interesting moment. But I think probably for most people, at least the Dead of Winter example is probably a bit more annoying than yeah. not.
And I don't want this to go turn into a design sure. episode, although I think we could do an episode on design.
Yeah.
In general, you know, basically graphic design and iconography and that kind of thing. Because honestly, what I think would be a solution for the Dead of Winter problem is you make all of the player characters a different, you know, instead of having a white frame, they have a yellow or red or blue, some other differentiator.
Or a base that's a different color.
Or a base that's a different color. So you can quickly identify who are the bad guys, who are the good guys.
All the zombies have red bases. The good guys have a different color or all different colors. So you can tell which person is which. And their little character card could have a band of color on the outside that matches their base.
Yep.
Not that I've thought about this at all because and actually, it drives me crazy. Yeah.
Well, Christy actually posted a picture of what she does for her Dead of Winter characters. And it's like little rubber bands that go around the base so you can color code them as necessary. But I think the point that I'm getting at here is whenever you draw a new survivor in Dead of Winter, you have to find their standee. And what I was doing is anytime someone needed a survivor, I would draw the card, I would immediately scan for that survivor, and then I would hand the player both the fiddly bit and the card saying, okay, here's everything you need. You don't need to worry about anything else. Because otherwise you hand someone the card and then they're kind of reaching over the board trying to search for it. So that's what started me thinking. It's like, I do this a lot. And then Gloomhaven... If you haven't played Gloomhaven, you should. It is a phenomenal game.
You need to find someone who has a copy first.
Yes. And there'll be lots of them in the next couple weeks, I think they should be shipping.
Right.
So many fiddly bits. So many. It is overwhelming in the amount of time it takes to set that game up because you have to find the board, find all the cardboard that sits on top of the boards, to like, you know, your rocks, your doors, your all those different things. Health for everybody. Monsters for everything.
Yeah.
Which are the standee monsters. I like the design decision there where the player characters are plastic and then the monsters are cardboard. So you can see a good differentiation there. But then you're managing initiative cards for every different monster that's on there. So if there's four different monsters, there's four different initiative cards that you're managing for the game. Plus you're managing your cards. Not to mention all the health that can happen. And when you do damage to a particular monster, that carries over. So you put, you know, their health changes. So you have to manage that as well. And there's just so much going on that half the game is spent managing the game. It's still all worth it. But...
It's like a cross between a board game and a role-playing game. And in a role-playing game, literally all you do is manage the game.
Yeah.
You are on paper. That's it. Like, that's what you do is it's all fiddly bits.
Well,
and to a certain extent.
To a certain extent.
But, you're just replacing bits with pencil and paper.
Right. But what you're doing there is removing the fiddly bit and making it so it's more of an accounting bit.
Yeah.
So it's another way of tracking that. In fact, with Gloomhaven...
It all comes back to the banker, though.
It is. It does. Yeah, it's all to the accountant. What we ended up doing for the monsters in Gloomhaven is using an app. Because that would handle all the initiative cards. And then you manage the health separately, but I would just have the big iPad sitting there, manage all the initiative cards, and then I only had to manage the health. I didn't have to worry about all of the other fiddliness that goes on.
So was this a dedicated Gloomhaven app that someone had created?
Yeah. So they took all of the monster cards, all the initiative decks, and then put them together. And on top of that, you could say, I'm going to play scenario 12, set it up for me, and it would pull out all of those initiative cards. Virtually pull them out. So I didn't have to search through my stack of all of the different cards and pull out the ones that are necessary for that particular scenario.
Because those decks are huge.
Yes.
There are so many cards.
So many cards. So Gloomhaven, if you're able to streamline that, you can play so many more games by streamlining the fiddly bits.
So you have Gloomhaven and you don't have this app, download it now.
Yes.
That's what we're saying.
And there's other things that people do too. So, you know, oftentimes in a game, you're going to get a set of tokens, you know, cardboard punched out tokens. And those will be your health tokens, for example. And, you know, ones and threes are a pretty common thing for health. So the idea here is you're going to stack the damage, and actually it's either health token or damage tokens depending on how you use them, but so you'd stack damage next to the different standee of the monster showing how much damage it's taken. Or you actually, in Gloomhaven, it's recommended that you put it on the card. So there's a card that tracks all of the monsters, like there's six different monsters, so there's six different sections on the card that you can put your damage on. The problem is, when you look at a monster on the board, you don't see he's damaged. Mm. But if you look on the card, you're like, okay, what monster's damaged? How many hit points does he have left? Constant question. How much does he have left? How much does he have left? So what we ended up doing was saying, okay, I'm going to get rid of managing with the cardboard. I'm going to actually use clear cubes and crystals, the plastic ones that just you can get anywhere. And that way someone can glance over and see a pile of plastic there saying, oh, they have a lot of hit points left, because we did not apply damage. We removed hit points, okay, which is not what is recommended. But when you glance down and you can see, oh, there's five red cubes there, means there's five hit points left. You don't care. You don't have to do any math.
Yeah.
If it's five red cubes means five damage, then you have to know, well, what is this maximum hit points?
Yeah.
Right.
How much life does he have left? And then you have to do that math.
Yeah, but then if you just see the pile, okay, he's got a big pile next to him, let's take him out.
Exactly. So that's what we did for Gloomhaven to make that easier and to make it something visually that you could just look at. Another thing I did is all of the stat cards have icons that represent them, but they're in a row. So it's attack, range, movement, and hit points. And you have to look at the icon, then you look at the number, then you kind of have to relate that in your head and try to match all those things up. So I'm like, no. I'm just going to get colored six-sided dice. A green die means that's its movement. A red die means that's its attack. It's a blue die if it flies. So you can just glance over, see the color, see the number, and know without having to like match the iconography in your head of like, wait, what does this go? This isn't a bow and arrow, so that's its range, but the sword is still the attack power. So I don't need to do that. Just kind of like fix that fiddliness.
Colors are a bit quicker than the icons.
Exactly.
Basically. Right, yeah.
Yep. So it's like, oh, how much damage is it? Well, the red die says four, so that's how much damage he does.
Nice.
So that's where I started, where I got to. Like I told you I could talk. I just did it for 7 minutes straight. But that's what I ended up getting to with this, is that's what I kind of want to focus on, is how do we make our games less fiddly and what can we do for that?
All right. So I'd like to throw out a our episode on tricking out your games.
Yes.
Is episode 37. And if you're interested in upgrading pieces and components to use for that purpose, that is that episode. So we are talking more about the distinction of like how they work here,
yes,
not just making it look cool.
Yeah. No, like I say, the plastic bits, those were essentially because they're easier to grab, easier to handle, and easier to visually see what's going, yes, on.
Not just because we like them.
Right. So we talked about first Martians.
Yes.
I think it's fair to pick on first Martians for fiddly, yeah, bits.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, definitely.
So we did set it up. We looked at it.
You say we. I think you set most of it up.
Well, I set it up. I had it all set up.
I was there helping, yeah, I think.
That's not surprising, yeah.
Yeah.
And it was all on the table, and we were ready to start playing. And then I think we tore it all down and played Time Stories.
We did. There are, like, I want to say like eight different tracks that you are moving your pieces up and down. You have to roll and move these pieces. And it's seriously, that is, you, for one turn, eight of the steps are move these bits.
Yep.
And we were just like, I can't. Yeah. Or maybe it was just, we were so into Time Stories, we didn't want to.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I think what it was is, and I don't know there's a way of fixing this particular situation, because First Martians comes with an app, and that's why we were trying it out, because we want to do an episode on app, you know, companion apps, or actually games with apps. And the app doesn't actually, there's so much fiddly bits in the game that the app could help manage that, but it doesn't actually do that.
Yeah.
So there is a way for them to fix that. If you've ever set up First Martians, you're going to put down a board, and then you're going to put down a bunch of little boards on top of that board that are always in the same order, as, at least from what I can tell, the scenario based. So in some scenario, it could potentially change.
Yeah.
But for...
Often it is the exact same setup.
Yep. So you put these little boards on top of your big board because each of these little boards has holes cut out in them. And the holes are cut out so that you can put a cube inside of the hole, which either is a green cube, meaning everything's good, or a red cube, meaning everything's bad on that particular thing. There are, I want to say, in the neighborhood of 30, maybe to 40 holes that you have to fill with all of these green cubes. So that at some point during the 7 turns in the game where you're taking 2 actions apiece, so a total of 14 actions in your entire game, the board, don't worry, the board takes 57 actions per turn, but that might be making that up, but it's pretty close. Sometimes you might remove a green cube and put a red cube in its place. That is a lot of work to represent that particular problem. When they could have just printed the board, put everything green, and guess what? If it turns green, take one red cube and put it on the green dot, and now that particular component is damaged.
But I think it was also as well that you were saying about how a lot of the changes that were happening each round, and you alluded to it just then, they're not decisions. They're just things that happen to you from the game.
Yes.
It's not like you're even making an interesting choice and then something happens in relation to your choice. It's just, oh, this has happened now, so move these fiddly bits. Yep. And you're like, okay, I didn't do anything.
The game is quite literally spent the entire time managing the fiddly bits, not actually managing what you want to do in the game.
So I'm going to bring up a game that we really like that is also super fiddly, but you don't even notice it. Time Stories.
Yes.
Time Stories is super fiddly. There's so much going on. We're dealing out cards to make locations. We've got dice everywhere that are going across the board being passed player to player. You have to move your time marker every time you do something or don't do something. Like there are tons of bits. But it makes sense in the game. You're making decisions that affect what the things do, and it keeps you engaged. So it doesn't feel like you're just,
moving
I have to manage
around.
These pieces.
Yeah. Right.
I think between those two games, because I don't actually think Time Stories has that many fiddly bits, but there are a lot of things that you're doing, and I agree with that. It's the fiddly bit management to gameplay enjoyment.
Yes.
That's the key. In Time Stories, the balance is fine.
It's great.
There's a lot of things you have to do, and we forget a bunch of times to move the time marker. But it's like, oh, wait, no, but you can fix it easy enough.
Yeah.
I also don't like the bits in Time Stories. I don't think huge wooden dowels are the right bit for that, but that's another story.
What's a wooden dowel?
Basically, a round piece of wood.
Oh.
They're like 2 inches tall,
like
two and a half
yeah.
inches tall.
Cylindrical,
and then you put a sticker on the top of it.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, but part of the thing of Time Stories is you're playing so many different scenarios, you don't want to customize the bits too much because they don't have that generic feel. They'll take you out of the scenario if, like, you're playing a zombie scenario and you have all fantasy bits.
Yeah.
You know, that doesn't make any sense.
That's a really good point. The bits are just inconsequential. They're mindless, but maybe that's on purpose so that you don't pay any attention to the bits.
I think it is. They are, however, very easily knockoverable by pregnant ladies because bellies get in the way.
That's true. Now, Time Stories, to managing it, one of the things that we ended up doing is saying, Kitty, you're in charge of the time track.
Yep.
So that is your responsibility. And that means one person can have to pay attention to that and not forget that piece, that step. And I think we do that with a lot of games where you kind of split up those responsibilities, those things that you are so easily forgotten just in odd places in a turn. Because you don't move the time bit in a consistent way, really.
You have to be aware of when you roll that die or if somebody takes an action, they have to tell the person, like,
right,
I'm doing this, move the time. And, like, you have to make sure that, like, all right, that person's doing something. Is anyone else doing something? We're moving the time for everyone's action. You know, so it's a little. Yeah.
Well, in that one too, it's like you move the time bit one step and then everyone gets one time step worth the actions they can do. So it's not like everybody has to do it. So if there's not one person in charge, it's really easy for everyone to forget.
Yes.
So.
And that's, I think, what we did our first playthrough. And then we'd go, oh my gosh, we did like three things. We need to move it three steps. And, you know, all of a sudden, oh no, we weren't paying attention to it. And now we're like almost out of time.
Yeah. Well, and there, so you brought up another one. So we talked about minis, standees, tokens, shared dice.
Yes.
This happens in a lot of games where you have custom dice and you have to pass them around. And they're always not in the right spot.
You're always fighting over, like, I need three to do my thing and you need two to do your thing and we've only got four and now we have to like take turns and ugh, who wants to do that?
Taking oh, I see, because it's just one set of dice and it's like, wait, there's two over there. Where's the fourth one?
Exactly.
Is this what you're talking about? Right.
Yeah. So I will say what I do with that now is I got these collapsible trays from Chip Theory Games, same people who make it'll come to me.
They make something else too.
Yes. Something too many bones.
Okay.
So it's like basically poker chips and stuff. But I got this as an add-on. And what it is just a dice tray. You can probably do this with anything. And we just keep the dice in the dice tray and then you pass the dice tray around and then you roll the dice in the dice tray. And then you don't have to worry about people splash rolling and, you know, throwing dice off the table.
But that's half the fun, Chris.
It is for you.
Also, that's what we do in theory. In practice, these dice end up everywhere.
It's because people don't stick to my rules.
Even you.
That's yeah, sometimes. You are the number one breaker of your own rules.
Well, I mean, yeah, but still, do as I say, not as I do.
Good theory rules, in theory.
So I was just thinking about two different games that have two very similar components that one manages so much better than the other.
Okay.
Pandemic, Century Spice Road.
Okay.
They both have the tiny cubes. In Pandemic, I cannot tell you how many times we have just like a mass of cubes over there because people keep throwing them in. And Century gives you those tiny little cups that they all sit so nicely in.
Oh, yeah.
That I want to steal out of Century and put in Pandemic.
I guess you're really angry when all those cubes are all like messy or whatever. I remember you were like trying to rearrange them. I'm
totally OCD about keeping the cubes like inside their boxes. And in Pandemic Legacy, something happens where like it is incapable of fitting inside that box anymore. And it's just like, it gets me like, I can't.
Yeah.
And I'm in charge. That's my thing. Yep. We often split up too, who's managing the fiddly bits by side of the board that you're on. So in Pandemic, Chris manages the city and all the cards that are coming out. And I manage the cubes because I sit on the opposite side of the table from him.
Yep.
And then, if I'm in charge of the bits, like they have to be organized. And whenever I play a game that has meeples, they're all lined up and all my pieces are all...
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because I ended up going out and I don't even know where I saw this. It must have been some image on BGG or something. So there are a lot of war games out there. And war games, especially classic war games, have hundreds of tiny little like quarter inch by quarter inch cardboard pieces to manage whatever you happen to be. Well, you have to manage all those little pieces. So war gamers have war gamer trays that they do that with. And I found a set of these and I will attempt to post a link in our show notes that are relatively cheap. I think I bought like 20 for $15 or something like that. And it comes with a base and a lid. And it's a 5x4, I want to say, compartments. So now, anytime a game has a ton of different types of pieces, I just pull out one of these. I fill that all the pieces in that tray. And then I put that tray in the box because it fits perfectly in a standard-sized game box. And then when I pull it out, I just pull it out. I take the cover off. And that manages all of the fiddly bits. Essentially the arrangement of them. First Martians, going back there, uses two of these trays. There's that many different pieces that you have to manage.
Is this what you had out for Dead of Winter?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep.
It worked really well for Dead of Winter, except when two people were trying to reach for the same bits.
Well, that's physics.
Yeah.
But that happens. but so this is one of the ways that I've started to manage things. Now, I've talked before about using like baggies and stuff and splitting up all of the pieces for a particular player and putting all of their fiddly bits in a single bag and then saying, hey, when you're done playing, put all of your fiddly bits back in your bag. So that's how you put the game away at my place, is you have your little player bag, fill it back up with the pieces that you had in the first place. And then it's much easier to set up the game and tear down the game because you can divide that up.
Yes.
Now, something, you still have a bunch of other things. So I'll pick on Great Western Trail.
Yes.
There's cards. There's labeled 1, 2, and 3 tokens that will get put on the board. There's different cardboard pieces that get set up. Every player has 10 buildings associated with it. Every player has a playmat that also has wooden tokens associated with it. So those, there's just a ton of stuff to manage there. So in that case, all the plastic bags, I write on each plastic bag what goes in them. And that way, when you pull it out, you know where it goes. When you put it back, it goes back in a place that's easy to set up for the next time.
And that way you don't end up with the mistake at the end when somebody's putting away something in one bag and then they close it up and it's all set up. And then you realize the last bag is too small for the last pieces of components.
Yep.
And you have to go rearrange all of the bits into all the different bags.
I have decided that Sharpie is part of the game room. Like,
labeling is important.
Yep. Right on the bag, what, because it, once it's all, everything's in the bags, you look, it's like, oh yeah, this is perfect. It's exactly how I want it. Once you empty those bags, you're like,
how did I do this again?
Exactly. So yeah. I read a lot of like cardboard, wood, that kind of stuff. Just, I mean, it could be generic, right? Like, yeah, all the wooden bits I want in this bag, all the cardboard bits I want in that bag. Or I might refer to them by their actual pieces in most cases. So Josh, you really don't care about this topic.
Oh, I really don't. Although that's funny that you said about labeling. I mean, I've even done that and might started to do that in my house. I am not this person, but I remember Gloria's sister is a very organized person and she would label her drawers. And Gloria said, why do you do that? And she's like, well, then I know where everything goes. And I was kind of like, as a person that doesn't care about this sort of thing and doesn't know how to do this thing and organize myself, that's a really good system and I'm just going to copy it. And I started doing that in our house and Gloria's like, where's this? Where's this? I'm like, look, there's labels on there now. You can just look. You don't have to ask me.
It's also really nice if somebody else is putting away your things. I cannot tell you how often I come into my kitchen and I'm looking for a thing. I know exactly where it goes. But, you know, my sister did my dishes and she put it back somewhere wacky. And now I'm searching through my entire kitchen looking for, you know, the thing that I want. And
if you can organize a board game, you can organize the kitchen.
Yeah.
And vice versa.
Vice versa. Definitely translatable skills.
Yes. So set up and tear down. We were talking about gaming tables a few episodes ago, and one of the things that we made a requirement, or at least, you know, Sydney and I were talking about something that we really want in a table, is something that you can just take your hand and swoop all the pieces off the table. And the gaming tables with the kind of
the wells,
you can't do that because it's, oh, there's a wall there. So you have to actually pick up all the pieces.
Yeah.
So that can be when you have like a pandemic, for example, where you have, I think, what, 40 cubes all there, you know, trying to, you know, sweep those into your hand. That's much more difficult to do when you're at a table with a well.
Is this 80 cubes?
It's a lot.
It's a lot of cubes.
Yeah. Is this the beginning of your new invention/business venture where you come up with a little vacuum cleaner for fiddly bits for board games? Because, I mean, I think there's an idea in there. I mean, this is a problem. What are you going to do, Chris?
So this is what I do with that. I have a lot of, I have basically a Kinko's office supply thing, a laminator, printer on all different types of paper and things like that. One of the things I have is cardstock. And cardstock is great to have in general. So if you're, especially if you're in the gaming world and you want to do any kind of print and play, printing on cardstock gives you some nice, you know, thickness to it. It's not just flimsy paper. So oftentimes what I'll do is I'll take cardstock and I will use it as kind of a shovel. You put the cardstock underneath the fiddly bits, lift it up, then you roll the cardstock, you know, not roll it into a circle. But yeah, it's like a dustpan. But then you can make kind of a little taco out of the thing, and then you can just pour it into any place that you want.
Or you could buy a dedicated dustpan for your fiddly bits.
I'm gaming dustpan.
I'm still on these home appliances. You know where I've got this idea from as well? It's the American Office when David Wallace gets fired and he comes up with this new business idea that he's going to pick up all his kids' toys with this specialized vacuum cleaner and he calls the company Suck It. That's where I've got this idea from. But
it's a really good episode.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
It could happen.
I sense a Kickstarter coming on.
Yeah.
They also make really nice plastic scrapers that do exactly the same thing for baking and kitchen use.
Oh. There we go. Those ones are kind of like a fat semicircle type of thing, right? They look kind of like a wedge.
I've seen ones that look kind of like a wedge and some that look more like they've got like a handle at the top. It's like a rectangle with like a handle and it just kind of scoops.
Would it work for game pieces?
The one that I have is not flexible enough to make it into like a funnel. I have one that just like I use for chopping that I'm making a lot of hand motions that Chris and Josh are nodding at, but are not helping our listeners. I'm really sorry,
but
guys.
We're silently nodding in agreement.
Yeah. So. Yeah.
Yeah. I think, honestly, the table I have right now has about a 3-inch, thickness, I guess. So you can't put your hand under the table and sweep something into it because there's quite a distance for it to fall, which is why I developed the scoop and shovel and dump. this is the name.
The new company name.
The new company
name.
Shovel dump.
Yeah, I love it. But yeah, I think you just need to get slightly more sophisticated than cardstock. I just feel like it sounds like these baking implements might be good. Just have a look what's
out
there,
man. We'll look into it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, the nice thing too is you don't actually need cardstock or anything. Every game, almost every game comes with an instruction book that can be used for that exact same purpose.
I was going to say a lid.
Or maybe.
You scoop it onto the lip and then floop it. You dump them out of the corner.
Floop it. Good word. Flip it. I like it.
We got all the new stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Let's see. Any other tips that we have? I don't know that we've actually provided a whole lot of tips. Michael, I'm pretty sure that if we weren't bashing things enough last episode, we certainly are this one. I think, really, though, for game designers out there, watch your fiddly bits. It's fine to have them. It's just make sure the gameplay is worth the fiddliness of it.
We're looking at you first, Martians.
We are looking at you first, Martians.
I feel like we should find more games to pick on.
Yeah. Well,
I feel like we were too mean to first Martians for something that we didn't actually play.
Yeah. True. Let's pick on Battlestar for just a moment. Because one of the things with Battlestar, there's two possible complaints if you're going to have a complaint about it. One is the length. Yes. And the other is managing the fiddly bits of little cards. So
tiny cards are really hard to hold in your hand.
Yep. And you have to shuffle these. You go through them really quickly. You have to shuffle them a lot. They are actually really the most fiddly piece of Battlestar. Dark Moon is a Battlestar that gets rid of little cards, and then you roll dice instead. And the dice take the place of those cards. And the way the dice work is there's four sides that have negative numbers and two sides that have positive numbers. Your skill, so if I have a 3 skill in blue, I roll 3 dice, blue dice, and in theory, one of those dice will have a positive number. And if I'm a good guy, I'm going to put that positive number out there. If I'm a bad guy, I'm going to be like, oh, I rolled all negative numbers. This is the best die I can contribute. So that's kind of the idea that replaces those cards. It also shortens in theory shortens the game. We have found that Dark Moon can take just as long if you're not actually trying to hit the mission objective. But that's a whole different problem.
Something it loses, though, is a bit of the flavor because each of those little cards does have more text to it, more abilities. It allows the characters with their specialties to have more specific tasks that they do well.
Yep.
Which is fun.
Yep. Which is why I think Battlestar is good with their fiddly bit to gameplay management. The little cards are fiddly, and there's a lot you have to do with it, and you're always managing it, and there's 5 different piles, and the piles are, you know, never stacked, you know, appropriately, neatly.
It's another game
it.
Where I fuss the whole time to keep it neat.
I actually bought some card holders for small cards from Broken Token. I think they're like $6 or $7 for a draw and a discard for each for a small deck, and then you can actually put multiple in there too, so you can have like a 5 draw or something like that. I think the next time we play Battlestar, I'm going to break those out and just put all the cards in the nice little holders.
But again, if they had used big cards, we'd be sitting here complaining like about the footprint of the game. Like, oh my gosh, all those big cards, you've got so many cards everywhere. It takes up like three tables.
Yep.
So, you know.
There's a game
pluses
that...
pluses and minuses to everything.
I'm not going to mention the name, mostly because I don't think I know the name off the top of my head. but it was a game that I really, really, really wanted to like. It was just a bunch of cards. It's a card game. But it's a card game that was sort of like an adventure type of game. So you're going through and trying to make your way through this dungeon.
Yeah.
I'm like, and it plays solo. So I'm like, great. A solo playing card game. No problem. Except for you have to put the cards out like 5x5. And there's a bunch of other little card stacks that go along with it. So I'm like, what I thought was going to be a simple solo game I could play wherever has turned into this, you know, I need a 4-foot by 4-foot table to actually play it. And again, the fiddliness exceeds what I am willing to put in for the fun of the game.
The air conditioning came on and your game was ruined.
Pretty much. Yep. Everything's blown away. I tried setting it up on a hotel table. It was never going to happen. Man, we are so negative this episode. did we help anybody?
I don't know. You always
helping. I was nice
to
time stories, I think.
You
I tried to be negative and I ended up being nice again.
Yeah. Nope.
I just really like time stories.
You really like time stories. That's good.
No one will play with me. Yeah. No.
One of the things I did forget to do was post an input thread on this episode. So I'm going to still post it. It'll just be a feedback thread. So do this. If you have a suggestion for how to manage fiddly bits, or you just want to rant about a game that has excessive fiddly bits.
Which is what we did.
Which is what we did. Go to our Board Game Geek page, which is at tabletopgametalk.com/BGG. And that'll take you right to our podcast page. And let us know about it.
Well, yeah. I
promise we'll post one for next week.
Yes.
I think, you know, if you're the Chris's and the Kitties of the world who often find yourself managing the fiddly bits and you've got plenty of Joshes in your life who don't care and turn up late and don't do anything, you know, post in this thread about what they can do more during the game. Because, yeah, I'd love to hear it. I need to know how I can help out.
Yes.
And thank you, Chris. And thank you, Kitty.
You're welcome. Course. You're welcome. All right. Let's wrap this show up before we vent on something else.
Indeed. Well, thanks for listening. And remember, we love your feedback. So consider leaving us an iTunes review and email us with comments or questions at tabletopgametalk@gmail.com. Finally, a huge thank you to our patrons, Emil Jilljam, George, Adam Harrison, Sam from New York, Jason Strong, Terence Miltner, Stephen Seitz, Alex Brown, Michael Ohl, Josh Arntz, Trevor Olson, Brian Arnold, Sean P. Kelly, John Merkel, Daniel Shepherds, C. Marie, Rudy Lou, Benjamin Heimowitz, Jerry Huang, Mike Smith, Stefan Danger Phillips, Caleb O'Brien, Josh Lewis, Jennifer Engelbrecht, Justin Willard, Christopher Dong, Jason Marks, Jeremy Fisher, Carl Hammond, David Radke, Lance Morgan, Nick Quickstra, and David Sellers. Until next week, when we talk about ancient games, keep playing games and having fun.
Good night. So next week, you guys have homework.
Oh, God.
Yeah, well, it's going to be educational. We're going to teach people about ancient games.
Fine, I'll do it, Dad.
All right.